I'm VOA's Christina Menenti with your worldwide news update. The ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah already may have been breached. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
Lebanese state media say at least two people were wounded by Israeli fire in southern Lebanon. The Israeli military said it had fired at people trying to return to certain areas on the second day of a ceasefire with the Hezbollah militant group. The agreement includes an initial two-month ceasefire in which Israeli forces are to return to their side of the border following their ground invasion of southern Lebanon in early October. The buffer zone would be patrolled by Lebanese troops and UN peacekeepers. I'm Karen Chamas.
Russian President Vladimir Putin said Thursday that Russia would use all the weapons at its disposal against Ukraine if Kyiv were to acquire nuclear arms. The New York Times reported last week that some unidentified Western officials had suggested U.S. President Joe Biden could give Ukraine nuclear weapons before he leaves office. Speaking at the United Nations Security Council, Ukraine's ambassador to the United Nations says Russia must be punished for its actions and rhetoric.
The response to the Kremlin's current nuclear blackmail and threats must include tougher sanctions and increased military assistance to the party defending itself, its people, and the principles of the UN Charter.
This comes after Ukrainian officials say Russia had conducted a massive attack against Ukraine's energy infrastructure on Thursday, firing nearly 200 missiles and drones and leaving more than a million households without power. President-elect Donald Trump is declaring a win on stopping illegal immigration through Mexico after talking with Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum. But she is suggesting Mexico is already doing its part and has no interest in closing its borders. The two spoke on Wednesday, just days after Trump threatened to impose sweeping tax tariffs on Canada and Mexico as part of his effort to crack down on illegal immigration and drugs. This is VOA News.
Honourable Senators, the committee has considered the Online Safety Amendment Social Media Minimum Age Bill 2024 and agreed to it with amendments.
The Australian Senate has passed a social media ban for young children that soon will become a world-first law. The law will make platforms including TikTok, Facebook, Snapchat, Reddit, X, and Instagram liable for fines for systematic failures to prevent children younger than 16 from holding accounts. Elsie Arkenstall is 11 years old.
I honestly think that they shouldn't ban it. I think that they should just put restrictions on it instead of banning it altogether because, like, teens, they're just going to go behind their parents' backs or the parents are just going to be chill about it.
The platforms will have 1 year to work out how they could implement the ban before penalties are enforced. Meta Platforms, which owns Facebook and Instagram, said the legislation had been rushed. Pakistani police have leveled multiple charges against imprisoned former Premier Imran Khan, his wife, and others for inciting people to violence. It follows days of protests and clashes in which at least six people were killed. Authorities said police arrested nearly 1,000 demonstrators since Sunday in and around Islamabad. Khan's wife, Bushra Bibi, led thousands of people from the country's northwest to march on the capital, Islamabad, to demand the release of Khan, who has been behind bars since August 2023. Khan already has more than 150 cases against him, but supporters say they are politically motivated. Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson said Thursday that Sweden has sent a formal request to China seeking cooperation to help clarify what happened when two undersea cables were damaged in the Baltic Sea.
With this request, we think it's extremely important to find out exactly what happened, and of course we expect also China to comply with the request we have sent to China.
The subsea cables, one linking Finland and Germany and the other connecting Sweden to Lithuania, were damaged on November 17th to the 18th, prompting German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius to say he assumed it was sabotage. Investigators have zeroed in on a Chinese bulk carrier, Yipeng 3, which left the Russian port of Ust-Luga on November 15th. Kristersson on Tuesday demanded that the ship, which currently sits idle in international waters inside Denmark's economic zone, return to Sweden to aid the investigation. Uganda's prime minister's office said at least 100 people were missing and 15 dead after a landslide triggered by heavy rains buried dozens of homes across several villages in eastern Uganda. On Tuesday, torrential rains caused the River Nile to burst its banks and flood a highway connecting Kampala to the country's northwest, according to the Uganda National Roads Authority and police. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Christina Menenti, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Afua in Washington. Today is Friday, November 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Amnesty International accuses Nigerian forces of killing 24 protesters during anti-government protests.
Amnesty said Nigerian police used excessive force on demonstrators who had gathered to protest the soaring cost of living. It said police killed at least 24 people, including two children.
Ugandan health officials express concern about the surge of new HIV infections among young people. A Kenyan NGO provides health care to vulnerable population. And one of Somalia's five semi-autonomous states suspend cooperation with the federal government.
But because of what's going on in Mogadishu and sort of a political crisis at the heart of the Somali people in Mogadishu, is creating opportunities for mischief such as the one that has taken place in Jubaland.
And Liberia's longest-serving senator and ex-warlord dies. Those stories and more coming up on Daybreak Africa. Human rights group Amnesty International says its investigation into Nigerian authorities' crackdown on anti-government protests in August showed state officials killed at least 24 protesters and detained more than 1,200 others. Amnesty's finding come amid growing concerns of a shrinking civil space in Nigeria. Timothy Obizu reports from Abuja.
A 34-page document report released by Amnesty International Thursday was based on eyewitness testimony and interviews with medical workers and families and friends of the victims. Amnesty said Nigerian police used excessive force on demonstrators who had gathered to protest the soaring cost of living. It said police killed at least 24 people, including two children. The casualties were recorded across Borno, Kaduna, Kano, Katsina, Jigawa, and Niger states. According to the report, police fired live rounds at close range, targeting the victims' heads and torsos, while some other victims were suffocated by the indiscriminate use of tear gas. Isa Sanusi, Amnesty's Nigerian country director, believes the actual death toll could be much higher.
Even on the day today that we are launching this report in Kano, many families are coming out to tell us that their children are missing. And many are believed to have been killed, and many are believed to be in secret detention. So therefore, the whole issue is far broader than what we have talked about in that report. This just goes to show that the Nigerian authorities are not ready to accept the fact that the people have the right to peaceful protest.
The August protests, which organizers called 10 Days of Rage, were in response to the soaring cost of living many believed was caused in part by President Bola Tinubu's reforms, including the removal of fuel subsidies. Nigerian police authorities have not responded to Amnesty's allegations, but have previously denied using live bullets to quell the demonstrations. A national police spokesman did not take VOA's calls for comment. Nigeria has a long history of police brutality despite repeated promises to be more accountable. During the protests in August, heads of security agencies held an emergency meeting and the chief of defense staff, General Christopher Musa, addressed journalists.
None of us here is happy to hear any Nigerians injured for whatever reason. It's our duty to protect Nigerians. We're going to remain focused, committed. We're going to respect human rights, the rights of everyone who is lawfully performing his task or his duty. But we will not relent in pursuing those that have continued to encourage unconstitutional takeover of government or subversion, or those ones that are into vandalism or destruction of lives and property.
Amnesty's report comes amid growing concern by human rights groups that Nigerian authorities are trying to stifle political dissent. Sanusi says authorities are not serious about stopping the use of excessive force.
The lack of accountability, the denial of the killings by the police and other government officials are just signs of the fact that impunity is still reigning in Nigeria. And that has to stop. It happened during NSAS protests. We have consulted them to ask for their comments, and they didn't say anything. But what we want them to do is to hold those responsible of those killings to account.
In October 2020, police brutality sparked massive protests against the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, or SARS, unit of the police. The protests ended in a deadly shooting at the Lekki toll gate in Lagos. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
December 1st is World AIDS Day, and ahead of the annual commemoration, health officials in Uganda have expressed concern about the surge in new HIV infections in the country, notably among young people. Reporter Magume Davis Wakarinji has more from Kampala.
Dr. Vincent Bagambe is a public health specialist working with the Uganda AIDS Commission, a government body charged with the prevention of HIV/AIDS in the country.
We found that we have 38,000 new HIV infections, and of these, 15,000 are occurring amongst young people aged 15 to 24 years. So that age band of 10 years is contributing almost a half of the new HIV infections.
Bagambe says new findings found that young women acquired infections from men aged 30 years and above. He says there has been complacency in messages aimed at fighting HIV spread, leading a drop in safer sexual practices such as using condoms or having just one trusted sexual partner. Michael Kanaku is a local leader from Buyende district in eastern Uganda, where this year's World AIDS Day will be commemorated. Kanaku attributes the new infection trends to higher levels of poverty and ignorance.
Because I had a real example when somebody was saying that it's easier to get 10,000 and win a cheap girl. Mature ladies are expensive. So people who are either sex goers and who are infected and are not kind can easily win younger girls who are cheap because they go for cheaper monies. They don't have restriction. They don't demand for marriage. They only fear pregnancy and not fear HIV/AIDS.
Kanako also says there are still myths that contribute to the spread of HIV. For example, some people believe that having sex with a virgin cures HIV/AIDS. Some societies also say washing genitals after sex prevents HIV infections. While others, notably young people, think that having sex while standing prevents one from acquiring HIV. Scientists say one of those beliefs prevents AIDS. The Uganda AIDS Commission also notes that people living with HIV/AIDS often face social stigma. Dr. Ruth Senyonyi, who heads the Uganda AIDS Commission, says World AIDS Day brings an opportunity to dispel such misconceptions.
One of them is that we remember to stand in solidarity with all those that have succumbed to the scourge and all the families and individuals that have been affected in one way or another by HIV and AIDS. However, World AIDS Day also gives us an opportunity for us to make what we call a SWOT analysis. We find what are our strengths, what are our weaknesses, opportunities and threats as we respond to eliminate the epidemic.
The U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, known as PEPFAR, has helped to reduce HIV spread and HIV/AIDS-related death across the globe. In Uganda, PEPFAR has donated over $3 billion since 2004. Among other things, the funds help to reduce mother-to-child infections to less than 3% of cases from over 20%. The U.S. funds also help provide antiretroviral drugs or ARVs to more than 700,000 Ugandans. At least 1.5 million people in Uganda live with HIV, according to UNAIDS. For VOA News, I am Mogume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
A clinic initiative in Kenya aims to provide health care to vulnerable mobile populations, such as truck drivers and commercial sex workers. The goal is to combat the spread of disease across borders in Africa, and Juma Majanga reports from the transit town of Mologo in Kenya.
It's a beehive of activity at this health facility, made of converted shipping containers in the middle of Mulolongo, Kenya, a town on the busy Nairobi-Mombasa highway. It's one of seven such clinics located in transit towns along the Northern Corridor Highway in Kenya and 50 others across Eastern and Southern Africa. The clinics are run by the non-profit North Star Alliance. They offer healthcare to mobile populations like truck drivers and sex workers and communities that interact with them. Henry Mwazige is a program manager at North Star Alliance.
As they move, again, the access to quality healthcare services reduces, and that's why we have to target them and bring those services closer to them so that they are able to actually help in reducing that chain of transmission or cutting off that chain of transmission.
Kenya's Ministry of Health says long-distance truck drivers and sex workers have a high prevalence of HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases. 75-year-old Patrick has been a truck driver for nearly 5 decades. We are not using his real name because he wishes to remain anonymous. Patrick says he tested positive for HIV after a work trip in Botswana. He had trouble accessing his medication in some foreign countries. But now, thanks to the network of North Star Alliance clinics, he is able to get his medications across borders.
Yeah, hospitali.
Now I can just walk into any of their clinics with my card, and once I show them, they look at it and identify my type of medicine, and they give it to me. If it is 4 or 5, they know my prescription.
Catherine Wanja, a sex worker and peer educator in Mulolongo town, tells VOA that truck drivers are their best clients because they are well sensitized on preventive measures.
Truck drivers have their own families, so we have to use the protection. To protect me and the client to protect his family.
To increase the reach, North Star carries out outreach services in collaboration with the communities. Eunice Mwikali runs a guest house and bar business in the area. She says the partnership between businesses like hers and the health facility has helped educate clients who are mostly truck drivers and sex workers.
For example, we advise them to use condoms, that is for protection. So we advise them to come to North Star because we have linked with them and they are offering free services. And if they're infected, we also tell them if they forgot their drugs to come to North Star, they can refill their drugs at any particular point.
North Star says it provided health services to more than 180,000 patients in the region in 2022, majority being drivers and commercial sex workers. Juma Majanga, VOA News, Mulolongo, Kenya.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Today is Friday, November 29th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com and connect with us on all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Jubaland, one of Somalia's 5 semi-autonomous states, says it is suspending relations and cooperation with the federal government in Mogadishu following a dispute over local elections in the region. Meanwhile, according to media reports, the federal government of Somalia has issued a warrant of arrest for the president of Jubaland state. This after a judge in Jubaland had earlier issued the same warrant for Somalia's president Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud. To find out more about the political tensions, the U.S. Douglas Mpuga reached Abdel Ismail Samatar, a professor at the University of Minnesota and a senator in the Somali parliament.
Well, Jubaland is not semi-autonomous. It's part of the Republic of Somalia, part of the Federation. But the recent election in that region of the country where the provincial president has been re-elected illegitimately, I think, because he's barred from running for a third term. But because of what's going on in Mogadishu and the sort of a political crisis at the heart of the Somali people in Mogadishu is creating opportunities for mischief such as the one that has taken place in Jubaland.
So what does this mean for the Federation itself?
Well, the Federation will be there. The Somali people, by and large, are committed to a union of the kind that they had. But what's taking place is what they said, if the heart of the person is sick, the rest of the body will ache and actually will die. So what I see is the political center of the country in Somalia, Mogadishu, and the presidency is the one that's driving these issues to the point where there may be a breakdown and civil war back in the republic. So the cause of the problem is the political crisis in Mogadishu, where the president is trying to gerrymander the law, gerrymander parliament, so that he can have basically an unopposed election for himself in a year's time or so. And therefore, the folks in the provinces who themselves are illegitimate are taking their cues from that. If the president is able to do that, why not them? And the Somali people, both in Jubaland and in the rest of the country, are really sick and tired of this.
A statement from Jubaland State House says their government has officially and completely suspended relations and cooperation with the federal government of Somalia. Which other option is there to solve that impasse, so to speak?
Well, I think the impasse is a political impasse. It's not a sort of a cultural impasse. It's not an impasse between the people who live in Jubaland and the people who live in the rest of Somalia. There is no debate among the people as to where the country should go.
That's Abdi Ismail Samatai, professor at the University of Minnesota, and a senator in the Somali parliament, speaking with VOA's Douglas Mpuga. And the death of ex-Liberian warlord turned Senator Prince Y. Johnson has been greeted with mixed reactions by citizens. Denise Nipson reports from Monrovia.
On Thursday, Liberians woke up to the news of death of warlord and Senator Johnson, who was sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury Department. According to information yet to be verified by VOA, Johnson collapsed in his bathroom during a shower. He was rushed to a local health facility and fell into coma before his death. He was known for his involvement in the Liberian Civil War, particularly the death of former Liberian President Samuel Kaduh. Johnson rose to stardom by becoming a senator of vote-rich Nima County for 19 years until his demise. The late senator was instrumental in the election of Presidents Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, George Weah, and Joseph Boakai. Kelvin Matadi is the National Vice Chair for Press and Public Affairs of Johnson's Movement for Democratic and Reconstruction Party. He says the late senator stood for the people of Nima and his country as a major political figure.
The people of Nima will refer to Senator Johnson as a Zodua. In Gio, many are dependable. Senator Johnson stood for the people of Nima for several decades. He wanted to make a vice president of Nima. And he did. I think it's clear that the leader emerged before Senator Johnson's demise.
Matadi praised the former warlord and senator for his contributions to Liberia's development.
And Senator Johnson built schools across Nima. He has one of the biggest universities in Nima. People on scholarship back home here in Monrovia. He had one of the biggest churches. So I think Senator Johnson lived a life for Liberians, for the last 2-3 decades.
The news of Johnson's death went viral on social media. Adama Dempster, an advocate for the War and Economic Crimes Court, tells VOA that Johnson's death is a loss for those yearning for justice.
It would have been very much important for the senator to have actually gone to answer to the many atrocities allegedly that were labeled on his name, both in the TRC and victims and survivors who continue to talk about the pain they suffered as a result of his role play in the Civil War.
President Joseph Boakai and former President George Weah have both sent messages of condolence to the family of late Senator Johnson. For Daybreak Africa, I'm Denise Nipson in Monrovia, Liberia.
And it's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, Chinedu. We begin the sports with the Confederation of African Football Officials, who have started their second round of inspections in Kenya to evaluate the country's preparedness for the 2025 African Nations Championship, CHAN, meant for players playing on the African continent. The delegation led by Dr. Christian Emerua, CAF's head of security and safety, assessed key facilities including major hotels, which are set to accommodate visitors 15 teams. Additionally, the inspected training grounds at Ulinzi Sports Complex and Kenya Police Sako Stadium, which will be used during the tournament. On Friday, the CAF delegation is scheduled to evaluate Kasarani Stadium, one of the main venues for CHAN, as well as Kasarani Annex, a potential training facility. Staying with football news, Morocco dropped one position in the latest FIFA rankings and is now ranked 14th in the world compared to 13th in October, despite a positive performance in the Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers. However, the team has maintained its top position as the number one footballing nation on the continent. They are followed by Senegal in second, Algeria in third, and Egypt in fourth. And now to basketball, where the road to the Basketball Africa League East Division Elite 16 got underway at the Nyanyo Gymnasium on Thursday, with four matches on the cards in the opening 2 days before action moves to Kasarani Indoor Arena for the remaining part of the eight-team competition. Kenya National Basketball Premier League reigning champions Nairobi City Thunder made a strong start in their quest to qualify for the 2025 FIBA Basketball Africa League with a 103-59 convincing victory against MBB of South Africa in Group A. Kiro Star from Cape Verde triumphed over Bravehearts Basketball Club of Malawi with a 89-58 victory. Kiro Star head coach Hugo Miguel da Silva Salgado said the victory was important, especially with a team that had been quickly assembled after they received their wild card.
On the way that we wanted to play today, and we did that well, our point guards control well the rhythm of the game. One or two bad decisions, but it's part of the game.
In other results, Uganda's City Oilers got their campaign for a third Basketball Africa League qualification off to a great start, seeing off Fox Basketball from South Sudan 77-47. Zambia's Matero Magic had nothing on Burundi's Uranani, failing 87-34 in a one-sided encounter, while Nairobi City Thunders earned a 102-59 victory over MBB Blue Soldiers of South Africa. And out of fencing, where top fencing nations from around the world are set to participate in the 2024 Men's Junior EP Fencing World Cup, scheduled for December 14th to the 15th in Lagos, which makes Nigeria the first sub-Saharan African country to host a fencing World Cup. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Chinedu, in Washington.
Thank you very much, Samson, and you have a great weekend. And that's it for this Friday, November 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming on board with us this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on our social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We're also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak crew, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington, saying have a great weekend, and please be safe, whatever you do.
Mudu, host of Health Chat. Join me for the latest in health news, wellness tips, medical breakthroughs, and much more. Our experts inside the United States and beyond will share some insights on living a healthy life. Tuesdays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA.
We are bringing women voices to the conversation on things that matter to the hearts and minds of women. From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent. We hear your voices. Our voices. Right here on VOA on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC.
VOA Africa presents the latest news about Africa and the world and its news summaries. Africa in Brief airs every day at 400, 500 and 600 UTC. Give us 5 minutes of your time to be brought up to date. Africa in Brief, your trusted source for news.